You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to two Milwaukee natives about how to combat extremism and how to keep young people from falling prey to radicalization.
First, when things go wrong in the course of a day, maybe spilling the coffee we just bought or running into a traffic jam, it's easy to blow things out of proportion. We might tell ourselves that the rest of the day is ruined and things will just keep going downhill from there.
Our next guest calls that thought process catastrophizing and says it's worth learning how to avoid it and turning our focus back to the things that really matter.
Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology and the associate dean of the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's probably safe to say that we've all thought this way, fallen into this pattern at one time or another. Why is catastrophizing so easy and so common?
Yeah, so a great question. It is really easy and it is really common. And it plays into just a way of thinking, especially when people are stressed, that they find themselves essentially something goes wrong and they find themselves really just kind of thinking through how it's going to ruin their day, how it's going to ruin their week, how it's going to ruin their career or whatever.
And what's so bad about doing it?
Yeah, so it's associated with actually all sorts of emotional problems. But the two biggies are anxiety, and then in the case that I tend to write about is anger. That when things happen to us and we evaluate those events in highly negative ways, we're more likely to get angry about them. We're more likely to get scared.
So what is the opposite of catastrophizing? What's the better goal?
Yeah, I think what I usually encourage people to do is when they encounter events in their lives that they perceive as negative, to really think through the true consequences of the event to the best that they can. So think through, what does this outcome mean? I hit a stoplight. I was hoping to get through it. Does this ruin my day? How bad is this going to be? And part of what you do there is actually think through, okay, so how long a delay is this? Probably 3 minutes. What does that mean in the grand scheme of my day? Chances are, once people have a chance to really sit down and evaluate that thought process, they see that it's not quite as bad as they originally thought it would be.
And is saying that it would be a good technique to trying to avoid to catastrophize things, does that mean that we should never get upset about things that happen in every day?
No, not at all. In fact, I sometimes and maybe too often see the opposite of that, which is someone describing something really upsetting, really disappointing, and then following up with, but it's fine, you know, and it's not fine, and it's okay to say it's not fine. I think the healthiest option is to try and really think through as logically as you can, what is the real consequence of this? And it's okay to be disappointed when things are disappointing. It's okay to be scared if something negative happens, or to be angry when something negative happens. In fact, it's healthy to feel that way. It's just the question is really about evaluating, what am I responding to and how bad is this?
So it sounds kind of like putting it into perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because I don't want to suggest to people that there aren't such things as catastrophes. There are, and there are things that do ruin your day or ruin your trip or whatever. It's just about trying to think through those, think about them in the context of your life, think about them in the context of kind of other people's lives. And to try and kind of grab hold what does this really mean, instead of thinking about that initial gut response, which is oftentimes, well, this is terrible. This is the worst thing ever.
We're talking with Ryan Martin right now. He's a professor of psychology and the associate dean for the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW-Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. And we're talking about our very human tendency to catastrophize things, to make them seem or feel like they are much bigger deals than they are. And I wanted to go back to something that you said, Ryan. It sounded like you were saying that we might have a tendency also to kind of think of it as the last straw. So if a few other things have gone badly or not the way we wanted them to in the last day, week, month, whatever, it's like, oh, great. Now this is happening. And we kind of, it's almost like we're putting all that frustration into the most recent event.
Yeah. So when people get angry, when you look at the situations in which people are likely to get mad, there's really two parts of the what we call the appraisal process. And the appraisal process is how we evaluate the provocation, the thing that went wrong. And the first part is actually pretty simple. It's when you evaluate the culprit, we'll say, you know, and it's when you say, okay, this is bad, this is negative, this is unfair, that sort of thing. But then, and that's primary appraisal. But the second part is really where catastrophizing comes in, and it's where you evaluate whether or not you can cope with this thing. So this is where you're really asking yourself, can I deal with this? Because if your interpretation is, yeah, this is bad, but it's not that big a deal, I got plenty of time, I'm not going to be too late, you're probably going to be fine. If your evaluation is, yeah, this is bad, and it's going to ruin my entire day, well, then you're more likely to get angry.
So we had some comments on Facebook. One is from Joel, and he says, don't sweat the small stuff, and 99.9% of everything is small stuff and won't matter a month from now. Is thinking ahead to the future, and as we said before, putting things in a little more context and perspective, a good approach?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that it makes sense to really think about things from that sort of, I don't know, eagle eye or bird's eye perspective. How big a deal is this? Will I in the future be thinking back on this problem? And chances are you won't. And that certainly makes sense. I think too, I mean, there's other approaches. You mentioned putting into perspective, which is related, but you can think about things in terms of other problems human beings face. And you can think about like, okay, so, you know, my computer isn't working properly, but it obviously could be so much worse than that. Those are other ways that, you know, people can deal with those frustrations.
Besides looking forward, it also seems like looking back in some ways could be helpful. For instance, if you've dealt with a similar situation, I'm thinking maybe something at work or maybe something, you know, with your family where it's not the first time that that's happened. You've dealt with it in the past. And yes, maybe it was an annoyance or a minor setback, but here you are today, you know, to tell the tale. So looking back and thinking, yeah, you know, this isn't ideal, but I've dealt with it before. Can that help too?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's an approach a lot of people can take, which is that sort of this too shall pass approach. I've dealt with this kind of problem before, and I'll probably deal with it again. I think the other benefit of thinking about past events is that it gives you the opportunity to acknowledge patterns that are emerging and then start to solve problems if you can. You know, if you own part of that pattern in some way, so maybe I'm consistently, you know, running into traffic on my way to work and it's making me frustrated, well, maybe I need to think about things like another route or leaving a little earlier or a host of other options or just accepting this is how long it takes. And I may want it to go faster, but I'm just going to have to, you know, choose better music.
or a great podcast or listen to public radio, right? We're talking to UW Green Bay psychology professor Ryan Martin about our tendency to make things a bigger deal than they are, also known as catastrophizing.
And we want to hear from you. Have you found yourself blowing little things out of proportion? What effect does it have on your mood? If you're able to avoid catastrophizing, how do you do it? What advice should you give to others on how to keep things in perspective? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk about anger and catastrophizing with Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay.
What do you think? Have you ever found yourself getting angrier than you should be about everyday things that go wrong? What have you tried in order to keep those things in perspective? Do you have some advice for people about responding to things when they go wrong? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
And let's go to the phones. And Justin in Appleton is up. Hi, Justin.
Hi there. How are you doing today?
Good. What would you like to share?
I would like to talk about how the state of health of an individual has a lot to do with their tolerance on any sort of situations that they might perceive as negative. Now, for myself, for instance, I could tell you that since I started the ketogenic diet and intermittent fasting, my tolerance for negative situations have gone way up. So I've been catastrophizing things a lot less. And I would like everyone to maybe take a look at their own health and make sure that they're getting the recommended daily requirements of an optimal nutrition.
All right. Thanks for that, Justin. And that's an interesting point, I think, Ryan, that, you know, how we are feeling in general, our health, our mental health, our physical health can certainly impact how we're able to respond to things.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And there's, you know, when you think about the equation that leads to why people get angry, there are other pieces than the ones we've talked about so far. And one of those is what's called the pre-anger state. And that is the mood you are in before the provocation. And it can include, nutrition and things like that. It can also include, are you stressed? Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you too hot or too cold? I mean, there's a billion factors there that can play a role and make it harder for you to tolerate those everyday annoyances.
Thanks for that call, Justin. And I was thinking, kind of going a little bit back to what Justin was saying, you know, we talk a lot about resilience and how much kind of elasticity we have in our emotions and in our ability to respond to things. If we are catastrophizing, does that lessen how resilient we can be? Because we're always kind of in that really high level of frustration.
Yeah, I mean, I think that related to resilience is this notion of frustration tolerance. You know, how much of a problem or how much frustration can you handle or tolerate? And, I think there are individual differences in that domain, with some people just not able to tolerate as much. But it's also, and I think related to what the caller said, there are times when we're able to tolerate more than at other times, the same people, right? And so, give the example, I slept poorly last night, so I've been pretty exhausted today. That means that some of those little frustrations that I encounter along the day might hit me a little harder than they would have if I'd gotten a full night's sleep.
And on Facebook, Deb said, most things can be treated calmly, but when I have an emotional tie to the situation, it makes letting it go pretty hard. Is it a good idea to evaluate how close we might be to the events at hand, what it might be reminding us of, losing someone close to us versus that traffic jam you talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I usually want for people when it comes to dealing with anger is, you know, first and foremost, to kind of be as insightful as they can be about why they're feeling what they're feeling. And sometimes that's a very easy explanation. You know, it's a thing that would make anyone angry. Sometimes it's a little more complicated, and sometimes it is tied to some past experiences we've had, that people just have a history of having been sort of bossed around, so they don't like being told what to do, and that's a particular issue for them, or the emotional connection to people involved might change things. All of those are going to be driving factors, and human beings are really, really complicated, and all of those are going to be factors. I think regardless of that, where that's coming from, it makes sense to try and pay attention to that. And part of that is evaluating the thoughts you're having in the moment.
We're talking with Ryan Martin right now. He's professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. And we're talking about the human tendency to catastrophize when things go wrong. And let's go to the phones. And Joan in Cresco, Iowa is up. Hi, Joan.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank the professor for putting a name to this syndrome. I wanted to say I'm in a retirement age, but a young retirement age, and I wanted to comment that I have an awful lot of friends who the catastrophe doesn't even happen, but they're overthinking or anxious about it before we ever do something. So whether it's taking a trip or traveling or going for a day outing, they're already thinking, well, it's going to be too hot or the car might break down. And I just have to laugh. So I came up with a saying. I had read somewhere a comment that said, life is messy and divine. And then I realized for most of us, about 75% of it's messy and about 25% of it's divine. So I added a corollary for all of them. I said, find the joy in the messiness.
That's great, Joan. And I'm guessing that you would not disagree that actually catastrophizing, how would we say that? Catastrophizing in advance, just in case, is not a great approach.
Yeah, no, that is really interesting. I was thinking of it as anticipatory catastrophizing.
Yes.
But that is really interesting. And it's there is a related concept that people have written about called misestimating probabilities. And it's where you actually kind of assume the worst is going to happen. And so that by the time you get there, you've already kind of worked yourself up about it and gotten angry about it.
Yeah.
And it happens. And, you know, people, provocations or these negative events don't have to happen to us for us to get angry about them. We can get angry over imagined events. We can get angry over events from the past.
Joan, I think you sound like a wonderful person to go on vacation with, just for the record. So, Ryan, and another thought process tied to anger is overgeneralizing. How does that play into catastrophizing?
Yeah, a lot of times these and a handful of other thought types kind of play a role together. And so overgeneralizing is when we use these really kind of broad language when it comes to evaluating events. So you get stopped by a stoplight. Again, I know I keep using that example, but you say things like, oh, this always happens to me, or this happens every time, or something like that. And you basically, you take a single event and you turn it into a pattern. And once we do that, we stop responding to that specific event. We start responding to the pattern, which makes it feel much, much worse, right? If my spouse leaves the milk out and I'm frustrated by that, which makes sense, right? I wish it hadn't been left out. That's fine. But if I say, oh, she always does this, then now I'm responding to that pattern and making it a much bigger thing than it actually is.
Let's make sure we don't let you go without getting some really concrete advice on how we can start practicing not catastrophizing things. The next time that something happens and we're like, oh, that's, you know, that just ruined my day, or that's going to ruin my day if it happens. What's a good way to interrupt that thought process?
So I think the first thing is to, once you realize you're doing it, identify that catastrophic thought and then try and replace it with a more realistic one. So ask yourself, is this the worst thing that's ever happened, or is this a mild frustration, right? So instead of saying this weather has ruined my day, you can say, I'm disappointed, but I'm still going to do my best to have a good day. The second part is really to be patient with yourself and know that this takes time, right? So you've spent a lifetime developing these kind of thought habits, and it's going to take some time to undo them. And so the goal is that you're able to do that as closely to the event as possible.
On the other hand, you were saying that it's not particularly helpful if something does go wrong and it does have an impact to follow it up with, but it's okay, or but it's fine. Is there a way to allow ourselves to be kind of appropriately upset, keeping it in perspective, but, you know, giving ourselves that outlet when it makes sense?
Absolutely. I think that for many people, it's really important to acknowledge that there is something to be angry about, that there is something to be scared about. And then I think the next step is really deciding what you can do with that anger or that fear that might be productive. So is this a problem you can help solve, or that you can solve on your own? If so, then work towards solving that. I think there is an art to figuring out at what point maybe you aren't able to contribute to the solution, or you aren't able to help anymore, and being able to let things go at that point.
Well, I think that's a really good point, Ryan, because it can be easy to feel pretty intense anger over things that we really don't have a lot of control over. It can happen with the news or politics. It can happen with planes always being delayed, a bunch of things that we really have almost no input or control of. Is there a balance of being realistic about those things, but not letting them take such a toll on us?
Yeah, there is. And it's awfully hard for people to myself included, to be able to find that balance and to acknowledge that, you know, there are things I can do about the state of politics in the world. There are things I can do about these kind of everyday problems I experience. Sometimes what I can do about them is limited because there's only one of me. But it's finding a way to try and change the things I can change, but also, you know, acknowledge that that at a certain point my reach or my power ends, and I do need to accept some things. Accept them doesn't mean say, okay, it's not a big deal. It means just find ways to let those things go.
Is there any room for humor in dealing with things when they go wrong?
Yeah. So psychologists talk about there being what we call incompatible mood states. So the idea is that you know, can't be anxious and relaxed at the same time, or you can't be angry and relaxed at the same time. The same goes in some ways, depending on the type of humor, for anger and humor, that you can't really be angry and sort of find things light at the same time. Now, that depends on the type of humor, because things like sarcasm tend to be a little more hostile and aggressive. But if we can find ways to make things sound or feel funny to us, it's a way of alleviating some of that tension.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Martin is a professor of psychology at UW Green Bay. He writes about anger and emotion at alltheragescience.com. He was with us to talk about the dangers of catastrophizing and how we can keep things in perspective.
Coming up after the news, a former white supremacist teamed up with a man who lost his father in the Sikh temple shooting, and they're working to turn the tide against hate and extremism in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, research from UW La Crosse helps to piece together just how the Tyrannosaurus Rex was able to move so quickly to catch prey. One finding, the big dinosaur was way more agile than you might expect.
Now, Pardeep Kalika's father was killed in the 2012 Sikh temple shootings in Oak Creek. And Arno Michaelis is a former white supremacist.
The two have teamed up to found the group Serve to Unite, which works to stop young people from falling prey to extremist ideologies. And they're the authors of the book The Gift of Our Wounds, a Sikh and a former white supremacist find forgiveness after hate.
They joined us from our studio in Wausau. Pardeep, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon, Rob.
And Arno, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Well, we could talk for hours about each of your stories, but I just want to touch on them a little bit before we get into what you're working on now. Arno, can you give us a story of going from this place of white supremacy to leaving it, to finding a different spirit in your life?
Well, the quick glimpse of it is just that when you are under the influence of a violent extremist narrative, it destroys your life. It destroys your ability to love, to connect with the world around you. And I look back on that 7 years I spent in that world as the darkest time of my 48 years. And today, every day, I'm very grateful that I'm no longer that person and very grateful to the brave people who helped to lead me here.
Yeah, talk about that, Arno. Who was it that inspired you to break out of that story?
It was primarily people that I claimed to hate who refused to capitulate to my hostility by reflecting it and instead demonstrated for me how human beings should treat each other. People like a Jewish boss, a lesbian supervisor, black and Latino coworkers all defied the aggression that I radiated into the world and instead showed me compassion and kindness. And that was a huge factor in my turnaround. It indicated in a very powerful way how wrong I was to think the way that I did. And it helped to change my heart and mind.
And Pardeep, you lost your father in one of the most horrific events in recent Wisconsin history, the 2012 Temple shooting in Oak Creek. What led you to not just live through that, but to say, what can I do to change things?
Well, just as Arnold spoke about defying, we wanted to defy what happened to us and really just get out into the community and transform that crime or transform that tragedy into one of inspiration and triumph. And we knew that we had a responsibility not only to ourselves as a community to heal, but we had a responsibility to the broader community as they showed up on that day and continue to show up, now 7.5, 8 years later. And we're still struggling with some of the difficulties of what inspired that shooter that day. But, you know, we're just grateful that we can partner up with the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service and really hammer home this message of love and healing.
And Pardeep, you and Arno, both from Milwaukee, very different paths in life. What brought the two of you in particular together?
The spirit. I mean, I don't want to sound a cliche there was a spirit of healing. And both of us at that time were trying to address wounds that we both felt from the past and from that day and really just understanding our own responsibility and carrying that forward and really trying to heal both ourselves and this community led us to that spirit that brought both of us together. And I don't think that we could have told you that this was going to happen, but we were both just working with that same spirit of healing.
And Arno, you guys work in particular with younger people and students as at this high school today. Why were they the group that you wanted really to reach out to?
Really, because Pardeep and I need teachers. And these young people are just such amazing examples of what's best about humanity and about the concept of hope and of progress and of working towards a world where all people are valued and included. And that's really what drew us to work with young people. They're the ones shaping this future. And despite all the challenges in our society nowadays, despite all the political polarization, working with young people really helps us feel good about the future, and we're excited to be at the high school this evening.
And Pardeep, as I understand it, the work the two of you do isn't just the two of you lecturing to young people. You bring kids on to work on things through the, I think it's called the Serve to Unite program. Can you tell us how that works?
Sure. The Serve to Unite program was formed as a response to what happened on August 5th, 2012, but then it quickly morphed into a program addressing positive identity development within schools, and that quickly morphed into addressing positive identity development within communities. And so we worked in schools for the major part of the last seven years, but as of the last 2-3 years, we have been really partnering with small communities, law enforcement, federal law enforcement, faith groups, just to address sort of the communal trauma that exists and persists in our society, and really understanding what we all can do to become a more connected society.
Talking to Pardeep Kalika and Arno Michaelis, co-founders of the group Serve to Unite. Their book is titled The Gift of Our Words, A Sikh and a Former White Supremacist Find Forgiveness After Hate. We see anti-Semitic graffiti found on a Racine synagogue, other vandalism incidents like that around the country, from events like this to shootings. Arno, does it get hard to keep up hope when you keep seeing more and more examples of the kind of things you're working against?
It's certainly discouraging. And for me, considering my past, I take racist, anti-Semitic, any hate-driven, targeted violence personally. I feel like it's a failure of mine when these things happen. And it really ratchets up the urgency that I feel to work towards a society where that's going to be less likely to happen. I'm not under any illusion that, you know, all conflict and all hate and all strife is ever going to end, but it's really about the process of peace and understanding how important that is and really getting to the point where you love that process. And if we can get people in society to love the process of their life for good, bad, or ugly, as the Sikh principle of Charikala is really all about. I think that's a very powerful antidote and inoculation against the kind of hate and really suffering and hurting that leads people to lash out in hateful ways.
Pardeep, one of the most inspiring things I saw after the tragedy of the Sikh temple shooting in Oak Creek, I think a lot of people would have understood if the community there had said, an outsider came and attacked us, we're going to wall ourselves off in some way. But what actually happened was the community there started inviting people in for meals and events. How do we react to events in a way that tries to include and reach out to other people instead of putting up barriers?
You know, the spiritual challenge that we face with 7 billion growing in a growing population worldwide is a spiritual challenge. And we can all understand when we sort of close off and we can, self-silo ourselves. But the spiritual challenge is really, can we be courageous and really embrace one another? You know, it's easy to embrace somebody that looks like you, walks like you, dresses like you, believes like you. But it's a spiritual challenge to embrace the person that does not. And so that's what our society is facing right now. We face a very spiritual challenge, and if we can embrace the future that our children are going to navigate, I think we're up to the challenge.
Arno, you came into and then out of a white supremacist hate ideology. When you look back, do you think there's a point in your life where if you'd heard the right thing or met the right people, it would have kept you from going down that path in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. The timing of my evolution and my path just happened to shake down so that these acts of bravery that people who, as Pardeep described, who had the spiritual strength to see themselves in someone who was absolutely not like them really changed the course of my life. And it certainly could have changed the course of my life had it happened earlier. And as my life was changed by that sort of spiritual power, I think that's why it's all the more important for me especially to try to set that example for other people.
And Pardeep, in one way you're reaching out to try to help people, to send a message to people one person at a time. But you mentioned earlier the idea of communities developing, I guess you could call it a kind of resilience to help avoid falling into hateful ideologies. What can communities do working together?
You know, me and Arno have traveled East Coast to West Coast, and we have been to mass shooting after mass shooting, interpersonal violence to inner city violence. And we want to usher in a spirit of healing survivorship, meaning that we can be stronger than we were before because we don't take life for granted. And I will say that personally, before the shooting happened, I took life for granted and I took my responsibilities for granted. And I think we do that too often. Our book is called The Gift of Our Wounds. And words is great too, but wounds, meaning that, we 500 years of wounds, last 50 years of wounds. What do we do, and how do we grow from the wounds that we've suffered? Not, maybe a mass shooting doesn't happen to somebody, but maybe they're suffering through their own personal wounds that they feel like they can't get over, or they can't get through. And what we want to instill in them is just a sense of hope.
Arno, when you work with young people one-on-one, do they inspire you, as Pardeep was talking about earlier? Do you feel hope working with young people today?
Oh, absolutely. My resilience is largely drawn from the leadership that our young people in not just the United States but throughout the world exhibit. I'm very fortunate to do a ton of traveling. I'll be on the road 8 months this year. I just got back from India, where I was working with UNESCO Mahatma Gandhi Institute for Education of Peace, and I was running workshops with a group of 60 young people from 27 different countries, all of whom were already engaged in really unbelievable peace-building activities, and they had all gathered in New Delhi to work with me to expand their capacity and become even better at the peace building work that they do. So that, things like that really inspire me and help me keep going in spite of any discouraging things that may happen.
And Pardeep, in our last minute, if someone sees something in their community, they see the graffiti or hateful messages at the football game or whatever it might be, how would you encourage them to respond?
No, they're allowed to be angry because it shouldn't make us angry. It's a natural emotion. But they shouldn't be so angry that they become dysfunctional. We have a saying in Sikhi, it's called Chardi Kalal, which means relentless optimism. And we have to be relentlessly optimistic that the moral arc of this universe bends to the good, and it will.
Pardeep, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Arno, thanks for coming to our Wausau studio.
Thank you, Rob.
That was Pardeep Kalika and Arno Michaelis, the co-founders of the group Serve to Unite, which works to stop young people from falling prey to extremist ideologies. Their book is titled The Gift of Our Wounds, a Sikh and a former white supremacist find forgiveness after hate.
Coming up, it's huge, with very short arms that have made their way into memes, but it's surprisingly agile, too. We find out how much trouble you'd be in trying to outmaneuver a T-Rex.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, not much research has been done on the medical uses of cannabis. That's because of it being illegal at the national level. But that leaves a lot of people who count on it out of luck and without much hope for a policy change. We'll find out more.
Now, there are some new findings about the Tyrannosaurus rex and its ability to move. And those come from the Rex Lab at the UW-La Crosse campus. Though we all know the T-Rex as a big predator to watch out for in dinosaur times, you may not know much about how it moved its large body and tiny arms fast enough to catch prey.
Eric Snively is a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, specializing in vertebrate functional anatomy and paleontology. He also runs the Rex Lab. He co-authored a study on the T-Rex's ability to turn in order to keep up with prey. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, before we get into this new research, obviously a lot of people find dinosaurs fascinating, people of all ages. What led you into the study of dinosaurs?
Well, I was 4 years old getting my hair cut in a barbershop in Utah, and there was a footprint, a dinosaur footprint, on the ground there. And I got interested enough that I never really grew out of it.
And you are studying how the anatomy of things like T-Rex, what it might tell us about how they move, how they behave, and things like that. How do we take what we have of a T-Rex, say, and figure out what that means about how they moved around on the Earth?
Well, we have to start with the bones, obviously. So we have fossil bones and skeletons, and we can infer a lot about the soft tissue biology of dinosaurs based on looking at muscles and other organs in their living relatives, birds and crocodiles. So if we take a bird, which is technically a modern dinosaur, look at its muscles, look at those of a croc, which is a relative, and we map muscles onto the form of these extinct dinosaurs, and we calculate properties of their bodies, so how hard it was for them to turn, how much muscle force they can exert, and so on.
Now, anybody who's ever thought about what they would do if they're confronted by a T-Rex, and I assume that's everybody, has probably thought what I have thought, like, no big deal. They're horrific and dangerous, but they're big and lumbering. They'll charge straight at me. I'll just run off 90 degrees. They won't be able to turn fast enough. I was wrong, it sounds like.
If you were going up against an adult T-Rex, then it would probably be a good idea to, move it 90 degrees and maybe try and get behind it. However, if it was a juvenile, you'd have a really hard time getting away from it. So the adults were adapted for going after large elephant-sized prey, and an elephant or a triceratops would have a harder time getting out of the way than a person would. But again, if you were being chased by a human or a horse-sized T-Rex, a little juvenile, you'd be in trouble.
Right. And so talk about what we know about how those younger T-Rexes then would be able to turn.
Well, all tyrannosaurs, including T-Rex, from juvenile to adult, had bodies that were actually pretty short from the tip of their nose to the ends of their tails. And objects that are short like that are actually easier to turn than super long objects. So a good analogy is if you have a bowling ball in front of you that weighs maybe 10 pounds, you can spin it pretty easily. But if you have a long barbell that's maybe 10 feet long, that will be a lot harder to turn. So by having a more compact body, it was easier for tyrannosaurs to turn, and they had bigger muscles, bigger leg muscles and tail muscles to help them turn than other carnivorous dinosaurs.
So it's kind of a ratio thing, it sounds like, this head-to-tail difference versus their, I guess, overall size and weight. It makes them, even though we think of them as really big, they're still pretty compact. Do I have that right?
Exactly, yeah. So a T-Rex that would weigh about, maybe 10 tons would be about 12 to 13 meters long. Other carnivorous dinosaurs, that mass would be a lot longer, and it would be a lot harder for them to turn. And also, it's a ratio of how difficult it is to turn versus how big your muscles are and how much torque those muscles can exert, how much twisting force. So if you have big muscles that can exert a lot of leverage and a lot of force, you can turn a relatively compact body more quickly than if you were longer and skinnier.
Now, what am I eating if I'm a juvenile T-Rex versus an adult T-Rex?
My colleague Joe Peterson at University of Wisconsin Oshkosh just discovered that a juvenile T-Rex was actually feasting on the tail of a duck-billed dinosaur that it had eaten. So we have tooth marks on bones of prey of tyrannosaurs. So we know that juvenile T-Rexes would have probably maybe eaten carcasses the adults have killed and probably gone after more agile prey. And we know that the adults went after large live prey because we see tooth marks in the bones of Triceratops and duck-billed dinosaurs that have healed. So a T-Rex tried to acquire that prey, but the prey got away in that case. So we know that adult T-Rexes at least were hunting large herbivorous dinosaurs.
Now, getting back to what we can infer from the structure, from the bones that we have, and I know we have some footprints and eggs and things like that, do we start to have an idea of what the ligaments and the muscles and the stuff that holds everything together and makes everything move? Are we getting a pretty good picture, we think, of what a T-Rex would have looked like just under the skin?
We have a really good picture. Because we can compare extinct dinosaurs with modern birds and crocodilians, we can infer that they had muscles that are present in their modern relatives. However, we can also look at the size of the muscle scars and the size of the muscle attachments on the bones of these extinct dinosaurs. Turns out that tyrannosaurs had really, really huge hips for really big muscle attachments. They had big crests at their knees for big calf muscles. And they had really deep, robust tails. So a muscle from the tail ran to the back of the leg, pulled the leg back, and drove the T-Rex forwards. And in tyrannosaurs, these muscles are huge compared with their body size.
I understand now you want to flip the equation and look at some of the herbivores and see what we can learn from their structure about how they would have moved.
It's pretty great. Some of my students here at UWL have made some computer models of these herbivorous dinosaurs, and they've used some of my methods to calculate how easy or difficult it was for them to turn. And the next stage is to look at the muscles of these big herbivores, so things like duckbills like Edmontosaurus or Anatosaurus, and or Anatotitan, I should say, and then big horned dinosaurs like Triceratops.
As we wrap up, Eric, if I were to say to you, Eric, I can give you 30 seconds of video of an actual tyrannosaur moving about, maybe hunting, what would you hope to learn from that?
I'd actually like to learn how they were using their heads and necks. So I imagine they would get in close enough with their ability to turn, and I'd like to have some of my own work tested on how quickly they could turn their heads. Turns out if you were standing next to a T-Rex, you couldn't jump away quickly enough. It would be able to grab and bite you. But I'd like to know what it was doing to attack these larger dinosaurs and maybe how it was excising flesh from its prey.
Full disclosure, I don't have such a video. But thank you, Eric, for sharing this amazing research with us.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Eric Snively is a professor of biology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, specializing in vertebrate functional anatomy and paleontology. He runs the Rex Lab on campus. He joined us to talk about a study he co-authored about the T-Rex's ability to turn in order to keep up with prey.
Coming up, cannabis is a more tightly controlled drug than cocaine or methamphetamines because it doesn't yet have a recognized medical use. We'll find out why it's so hard for that research to be done. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're guessing that many of you traveled to get to the home of family members or good friends to celebrate Thanksgiving today. While some of you might have driven, there's a reason why the Thanksgiving weekend is one of the highest air traffic times of the year.
So there you are enjoying an awesome meal or two or more, and there is still so much food left. The hosts offer you leftovers, but you have no idea what you can bring on the plane.
Don't worry, we have you covered. Actually, the TSA has you covered. They have a very detailed website that tells you what you can and can't bring on board, including food, either in a carry on or in checked bags.
For example, cooked meat, seafood, or vegetables, no problem. Just make sure there isn't any liquid.
Creamy dips and spread, no limit in checked bags. For carry-on, though, it falls under the 3 ounces or less rule. Ditto for that gravy and cranberry sauce.
Good news on the pie front. You can bring as many with you as you want. Same with those dinner rolls.
So load up and enjoy. You can even pack a little of everything for your in-flight meal. I look forward to traveling with like just a plastic baggie with filled with 3 ounces, precisely 3 ounces
exactly.
of gravy.
Or sitting next to the person that brought it with them. Happy Thanksgiving.
The straw, open the bag, the straw, and the gravy.
There you go.
That's good, plain food,
but
people.
But what does the pressure, the cabin pressure, do to it? Well, happy Thanksgiving from
no
all of us.
No gravy explosions. This is Central Time. Happy Thanksgiving.